This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You wonder how this plays out with school choice, right? If you have schools that basically are for like all the kids in them are band geeks, smart band geeks, for example, you know, then it's just all one big click. I guess they still find some way to divide.
Yeah, there's fine tuning.
There's fine tuning, right?
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Mariel Bowser of Education Policy, Dara Z. Handler.
Thanks, Mike. I wish I was that politically savvy.
Well, you know, let's explain to our listeners who may not be living inside the Beltway. Mariel Bowser is whom?
She is the Democratic nominee for the mayor of Washington, D.C. And in this town, the Democratic nominee usually wins the election. Always wins the election.
Oh, has always, to this date, won the election. So she is most likely Washington, D.C.'s next mayor. The primary was on April 1st, April Fool's Day. Come on, guys. They got to do better than that. And Dara, what was turnout like?
It was horrible. 23% or something like that. Depending on, I actually saw a really cool map at WashingtonPost.com that kind of mapped out voter turnout by precinct. And we know that precincts map very strictly in this town to things like race and socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see where the voters were and how things changed from 4 years ago.
Yeah, like, I mean, this is, it's just depressing. I mean, something like 60,000 votes and that's it. And look, I believe that D.C. should get a vote in Congress, you know, somehow, whether it's statehood or whether you merge it with Maryland, I don't know, something. But I have to say, the voters of D.C. could have made their case a little stronger by showing up to vote for their mayor.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's completely justified. I was going to say maybe people don't vote because it's a primary, but in this town, the primary is everything.
Come on, come on. All right. And the big question is Mariel Bowser a fan of education reform and a fan of Kaya Henderson, a fan of charter schools? Do we know any of this at this point?
Yes. She says yes to all of the above, that she thinks that the foundation for improving DC public schools, including charter schools, is solid and is going to evaluate the job that everyone is doing, which of course she would have to do because she's not going to blindly accept the appointments of her predecessor, but she seems to be on board with what's been going on so far.
Well, all right. This is not another Bill de Blasio, then, is what we're talking about. That
absolutely
is
not
good news. Okay. And speaking of which, we're going to get into all of that in Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, let's get started.
New York Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo have hammered out a tentative deal whereby New York will implement universal pre-kindergarten for four-year-olds and whereby the state has barred the mayor from charging rent to any charter school co-located in a public school building. How does this shake out?
Well, so first of all, let's face it, the mayor lost on both counts, really. I mean, he got the pre-K, but he wanted to get the pre-K by taxing his rich residents for it, and he did not get that part. Cuomo said no new taxes in New York City. Here, just take the money. On the charter thing, he slapped the mayor down, also said you will not charge rent to Ava Moskowitz and the other charter schools.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. What I really wonder is a lot of what's been written about this issue is saying that there's big implications for federal policy for charter schools, for state policy for charter schools, that this is going to have, you know, a big ripple effect on who pays for pre-K and charter policy as well. And, you know, I was wondering what you thought.
Yeah.
Is there a ripple effect here?
I don't know. You know, so let's talk about the charter piece, first of all. I mean, maybe you don't want state policy with this kind of mandate, right? There's a lot of people in the charter world who would prefer for charters to just get some cash that they can use for paying rent or for putting on a mortgage for their facility. They don't necessarily want to co-locate with the traditional public schools. In fact, there are charter schools in upstate New York who don't see this as a good deal for them. I don't quite understand all the intricacies, but I think perhaps they may end up with less funding for facilities than before. So we have to be careful. This was definitely not the preference of the charter community. But look, when you have a mayor who is clearly on a warpath against charters, you know, then you go up a level to the governor. And look, the politics of this are pretty interesting. To me, it says, follow Diane Ravitch's advice, watch your poll numbers plummet, and you know, give your political opponent, the governor, a chance to be the hero. I love it.
Do you think, though, that there's room for even federal policy for charters and facilities funding?
Well, I think it's tricky, right? Because there has been. There's a credit enhancement program that the federal government has put money into. There has been an incentive program for states to offer funding for facilities to charter schools, and those have helped at the margins, I think. Probably credit enhancement more so than the other one. So, you know, there are some incentives. The trick is that it gets you into this question of, should the federal government be funding school facilities? That has always been highly controversial. Generally does not. And it gets you into all the Davis Bacon labor stuff. It's just a kind of a mess. So I don't expect big action on the federal front anytime soon. Look, I think it raises this issue, though, of facilities. Facilities have always been the Achilles heel of the charter school movement. They cannot tax taxpayers in the same way that local school districts can. And so in a lot of places, they're spending a huge amount of their budget on facilities, and that's a problem.
Well, you also have state leaders who might be reluctant to say, well, if charter schools can't get local funds for facilities, then we're going to supplement that with state funds. And then you end up with charter schools getting more state funds than traditional district schools do.
That is not a problem anywhere, Darren.
Well, I am not saying it's a problem. I'm saying that state policymakers might be reluctant to take that step. And perhaps, you know, this is where the feds potentially see their role as coming in. Whether or not that's overreach or not is a different story.
Of course, in this week's Education Gladfly, our April Fool's Day edition, we came up with the perfect solution for this problem. The Success Basement Academies, the charter schools and Ava's mom's basement. That was one of my favorites.
Whatever works.
Whatever works. Okay, what's topic number two, Pamela?
New research from the Education Trust on High Achievers finds that poor and minority students on average graduate with lower grades, pass fewer AP exams, and don't do as well on the SAT or ACT as do their richer, whiter peers. What's causing this trend?
So, Dara, we're not doing a research minute here, so we're not going to delve into any methodological issues here. But coming into high school, the high achievers diverge, and the wealthier, whiter kids tend to do well in the end, and you see more falling off for the poor minority kids. What do you think?
I can respond to that with a methods issue.
All right,
you're hamstringing me here.
Go ahead. What's wrong with this study?
I think it's not something that's wrong with it. I think it just reveals the difficulty in how do you define someone as high achieving.
Yeah.
And someone with a 4.0 grade point average at a low performing school does not mean the same as someone with a 4.0 grade point average at a high performing school. So even saying that there's a disparity between high achievers across races in terms of these other measurable outcomes, like an SAT score that is the same no matter how good your school is, it's on the same scale. I don't think it's misleading. What I think is that this study reveals just a very important point, that there are disparities between high performing and low performing schools, and that when we say high achieving in terms of GPA, we are shortchanging the 4.0 kids at the low achieving school because we think that they're doing okay because they have a 4.0.
And that's what's devastating, is that those kids, the valedictorians, it's possible that if they were put in a low poverty school, in an affluent school, probably in the suburbs, let's say, that they might be at the 25th percentile, the 50th percentile, maybe the 75th percentile of that school. They almost surely would not be at the top. And that is a big argument. That's always been one of the arguments for standards-based reform, right? Is to say the reason we need standards statewide is because if not, you have different standards that are local and you're going to end up having lower standards where the kids face more challenges. You know, I also wonder about the tracking issue here. We had a study a few years ago from Tom Lovelace at the Brookings Institution who found that after the big detracking push in the 80s and 90s, many urban schools detracked, and they followed the advice of the detrackers, and they ended up saying, we're not going to have these honors classes and these advanced courses for the high achievers. We're going to teach everybody together. The suburban school said thanks, but no thanks, right? And so you have a dynamic where, look, the more affluent kids or the kids in the suburbs have a better chance of getting to be in those honors classes that are pitched at a higher level with stronger peer effects, with faster, you know, instruction, all of that. Kids in the urban schools don't get that as much. I think that's a problem.
I think, though, part of it, Mike, is content. I taught in an urban high school, and there were plenty of classes that were called honors. Yeah. Honors English, honors algebra. You took the students who were in senior honors English, and they were not, the kids who got A's in senior honors English were not doing nearly as well as your suburban eighth grader.
Yeah.
And but there's a lot of pressure on these schools to bring up achievement. And if your measures are internal, school defined, like grades, or even teacher defined, like what constitutes an A in my class or a B in my class, and how many standards do you have to know to get an A versus how many standards do you have to know to be labeled proficient on an exam? I think we need to be really careful.
Look, I'm glad Education Trust is interested in high achievers. I do wish they'd worry about high achievers regardless of their race or class, right? White high achievers and affluent high achievers don't get well served in our system either, I would argue. But then again, our friends at Education Trust are good lefties, and so they probably won't do that. Okay, topic number three.
A new study finds that, contrary to common belief, nerds and nonconformists aren't the only ones getting picked on in high school. Teens in the process of becoming more popular are 25% more likely to be bullied than the average student. Is this surprising?
So what I love is that in the process of becoming popular, we have value added scores on popularity now at the high school level. That's impressive. Good work, researchers.
I have to laugh because this, to anyone who was smart in middle school, this is the most obvious finding ever. How do you not get picked on? The answer is not, like, there's plenty of nerds who don't get picked on. There's plenty of band geeks who don't get picked on. How do you do that? You find people who are like you, you stick with them, and you have an awesome group of friends that's like you. So the fact that they're finding that the movers get bullied, when you move, all of a sudden, you're high profile.
They're the turncoats, right? They're the ones crossing the aisle in the cafeteria, right?
Yeah, you become high profile. You're now leaving behind the stability of the people who are like you and love you and support you, even though you went to the Star Trek convention last weekend or whatever. And you're leaving them behind. Now, all of a sudden, you're a target.
I mean, personal experience, Pamela, have you seen 16 Candles? Any of those classic movies? Hello. Now, Pamela at a staff meeting claimed that she didn't see any of this in her girls' school growing up, which only made us think that she must have been the popular one in school not being picked on, because we all know, of course, there was all this going on.
We had cliques. So.
Cliques. You had cliques. Yeah. So if you've stuck, that's the idea, that if you stick with your clique, then you're okay.
Yep. And as a proud member of the band geek musician smart kids clique, people who I am still best friends with to this day from elementary school and middle school, I can say, stick with your group. They'll be with you. No bullying.
There you have it. I do wonder how this plays out with school choice, right? If you have schools that basically are for like all the kids in them are band geeks, smart band geeks, for example, you know, then it's just all one big click. I guess they still find some way to divide.
Yeah, there's fine tuning.
There's fine tuning, right? But adolescents will find a way to distinguish themselves from one another.
That's very true.
All right, that's all the time we've got for Part in the Gadfly. Now it's time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, we did have some fun this Tuesday, April Fool's Day.
Lots of fun. Although, I told you guys this already. Every year, my contribution gets cut. I want to say that maybe researchers aren't funny, but Dara's contribution remained.
You know,
it's only because I wrote a completely deadpan. It wasn't humorous.
Right.
It was a sarcastic idea that I wrote straight humor, no actual
maybe
humor.
Maybe that's what I need to do. Like, not try to be funny, just be deadpan.
Honest too, Dara? I don't want to hurt your feelings here, but there were some people who didn't think that piece was terribly funny, but I have to say it had two charts in it. And I was like, I'm sorry.
I think that's the key. Last year I had one chart. This year I had two charts.
And I think And I wish I shortened it some, but I thought it was still pretty funny.
I tried pop culture.
And so did you have a favorite, Amber?
Gosh, that's kind of tough. I think the school bus.
That was my favorite, too.
that school bus drivers add about 9 months of value on average.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
Of course, your research team likes that one.
Of course, that was a good one. The great thing was that the School Bus Drivers Association retweeted that one and is now following me on Twitter. Yeah, and would like the actual study to be done. Yes.
That was good stuff.
All right. Check it out, people. Check it out on our website if you don't know what we're talking about. All right, Amber, what you got for us this week?
I feel like this kind of goes along with the April Fool's theme. We have 2012 PISA results. This is the very first iteration of the PISA problem-solving assessment. It tests the world's 15-year-olds on their ability to creatively solve problems.
Are we talking like they get handed a Rubik's Cube?
Oh, you're going to get some examples. Oh, okay. The online test was administered to a subsample of the students assessed in PISA's other core subjects. About 85,000 15-year-olds in 44 countries participated. Roughly 1,200 U.S. kids took it. Tested students' ability to solve real-life problems, such as how to deal with an unfamiliar vending machine. Mike?
Are you serious?
Not kidding. Or a malfunctioning electronic device.
No.
So, just to make sure we all understand, this is not a content knowledge test. The results were correlated closely with earlier PISA results on math, science, and reading. Singapore, South Korea, Japan, and Hong Kong topped the list. The U.S. was just above the OECD average, and Finland, Canada, and Australia were in between. One bright spot. There were many. But anyway, they calculated the difference between our observed and expected scores based on how we scored on the earlier core subject areas and said that our kids performed better than expected on interactive tasks, meaning that they had to uncover useful information before solving the problem. I have no idea what that means. And the report writers conclude that the U.S. kids are open to novelty and they dare to use their imagination. Anyway, I don't know if you saw Rick's post on this earlier. But
the thing that resonated with me was,
like, Asian countries come over all the time, right, trying to find out the secret sauce for our creativity and our imagination and our entrepreneurship. And they came out on top. So what are we testing with this thing? I just don't know.
So that is interesting. So the point that you just made was there are no trade-offs, right? You can both test well in math and science, like the Asian countries do, and also test well in figuring out how to get a soda out of a vending machine.
Yeah, that's right.
Was kick the vending machine an option?
I don't know.
Or was that the American response?
For electronics, I mean, you know what? The restart option is always the one I use. That usually does it.
What were the options? Really good? I don't know.
Call someone else an option?
Look, let's be clear. It's not that these other things don't matter. We do care about creativity. We do care about innovation. But, this does not sound to me like they maybe
measured
nailed it.
Right.
Right. It's like, how do you test that stuff?
Right.
And why is the American, it's our culture, not our schools, that is the reason we do so well in creativity and innovation. We have a healthy disrespect for adult authority, right? That is what's in our culture, right? We are not, we're not lemons leaping over the cliff.
Yeah. Now, I love when I went to China and they were teaching the kids how to be creative by making sure that they all sat in rows and nobody raised their hand and they were all listening intently.
Yes. Exactly.
Did you see this? Maybe you saw this, where the recent Atlantic article about smothering our kids and how our playgrounds are actually turning into these super sterile environments that are stifling creativity because kids have to play on them in a certain way.
I hear you. I totally. Look, I came home last night. My boys were up in the treehouse with hammers and saws and dangerous objects, right in line with the Atlantic. That is now considered good parenting.
Good parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I don't know.
All right. Well, that is interesting. The one PISA test we do. You know, when I saw this come out on April Fool's Day, I really did think it was a joke.
Bad timing. Really bad timing.
It is something of a joke. Ooh. All right. Thank you, Andreas Schleicher. Really appreciate it. It's like he's going out of his way to try to find something American kids are good at.
Yes.
So next time we'll just have a video game test. And we'll see how we do in Grand Theft Auto or something like that. Okay, that is all the time we've got for now. Until next week.
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.